Creative products are much, much more open-ended. And that's fantastic because it means the TAM is like absolutely gigantic. But it also means that you have to make more kind of hard choices versus if you're building like a very vertical application for one specific use case, one specific customer, then your roadmap to some extent, I think, is kind of more clear, right?
Hi, I'm Jubin, operating partner at Kleiner Perkins, and I'm excited that you're tuning into Grit. The goal of this is not for it to be a highlight reel of how successful my guests are, rather a candid exploration of how hard it is, both personally and professionally, to create, build, and scale world-class organizations. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe, leave a review, and make sure to follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter. Thanks.
What did you think of the last couple of days?
It's awesome.
I was watching you when we were sitting there listening to, I don't know, like amazing guests or whatever. You're like cranking away on your laptop. Do you feel like guilty being away from work, or do you feel like you need the space? Like, what's your like internal state being away from the work but doing stuff with 70 other founders?
Yeah, I think so. But I think also because my team is based in London, right? It's like I'm trying to catch up to the entire day before that. And obviously there's a lot of like important stuff going on right now. But I feel okay. I always feel like less anxious if I'm like somewhat online and just like do the bare minimum.
Yeah.
No, but it was great. I think great speakers. Like I'm always less interested in sports stuff because I just can't relate to it. So maybe that's those talks. I'm a bit more on my laptop than like Jeff Dean, for example.
Mm-hmm. When we were sitting at dinner, actually, we were all at the same dinner table. We were having a fun conversation about kind of the unique spikes of founders that also tend to be their unique weaknesses, and how the reason that you can go give everything up in your life, explore the wilderness like you did for like 3 years trying to figure out a company when you could have had like every other career path basically at your disposal, is like some screws are loose. And those screws are the positive things that impact the business and move it forward, but also the things that are like your Achilles heel in like normal day-to-day life. It was cool having that conversation with a bunch of people who have a bunch of screws loose that are all like, oh yeah, like, this is at home too. Like this is how with your partner, like this is the things that you do. That was fun, wasn't it?
It was really fun. Because everyone feels like that. You know, I think everybody knows their strengths. I feel like it is around that table and generally founders I meet. And they all know what it means for like their personal life and the weaknesses that it also brings with it, right?
Yeah.
Because often the things that are important in business are not always the same thing that's important in home life.
Yeah.
And learning to separate those two is pretty hard when you're an obsessive personality, which I think most founders are in some direction.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm thrilled to be doing this. Josh, first time on.
First time.
Very exciting. When did you two first meet?
We actually met here, I think.
Did Josh reach out to you?
I must have. I think this is back in 2019, I want to say, or 2018. This was just after the seed round, maybe, or just before.
I know when it was. Seed Camp, which was one of our seed investors, they did this trip where they would bring some of their portfolio companies, both East Coast and West Coast. And the setup was basically you'd come in, it was like these very, very early stage companies. You get like 15 minutes with one partner or principal from like most of the great funds. And I think I actually didn't talk to you. I think I talked to Annie here. And then she introduced me to you. And then like a couple of months later, I was back in the Bay Area. And I think we met all the way up in Menlo Park. And we had a great conversation. But this was at a point in time where the business was, it was very much like the wilderness period. Like we clearly had some cool tech driven some revenue. It wasn't like a complete disaster, but I think it was hard at that point to extrapolate where the technology would go and that we could build like a really great business around it.
Yeah.
But I remember we had a great conversation.
Come on, don't bullshit. Are you being serious?
No, I am, because I remember we were talking about, I don't know why we talked about music production, but we did, because that's like my big hobby when I'm not working, right? Uh-huh. And then we talked about Rubik's Cube, because I remember like I had my back at the time, I was like obsessed with Rubik's Cube. So like when I was in the cab back and forth from Menlo Park to San Francisco, I would do like Rubik's Cube. And Josh was like, is that a Rubik's Cube? It's like, yeah, it's a Rubik's Cube. Like, do you do that a lot? I was like, yeah. But then we kept in touch, right? And then I think it was, then a few rounds, Series B, we connected again. And I think at that point, we had a bit more traction and a bit more of a vision for not just how awesome the technology was going to be, but like what problems we could solve for real people in real businesses.
Yeah, but at this point, like this was what, 2019, 2021, when
we invested,
when we led the B. It was like AI was not cool yet in the same way. Were you even calling Synthesia an AI platform? Was it even an AI platform at that point?
I think we started using the word platform, but it was definitely at a time where, I think at that time, right, there was a lot of disappointment in how kind of like the AI companies of the last 3 or 4 years had kind of done. Like, there's a big hype cycle at some point, right? And people got very excited about machine learning and data analysis and more kind of predictive AI. And I think a lot of those businesses just, they just turned out to have like a bunch of problems that were hard to solve, which a lot of them are now probably being solved by generative AI LLMs, right? Where one of them was just the functionality, like, are they actually good enough to warrant like a big investment from whoever customers you're trying to sell it to? And second was like the margins, right? Where usually it take a very long time to get these things running. Inference was quite expensive. And there was of course like some great AI companies, but I think from my POV at least felt like there'd been a kind of a pretty big letdown in how most of these AI companies were kind of doing. That was the market we were trying to raise in, where in 21, most people were still just very excited about like vertical SaaS.
Josh is still excited about vertical SaaS in his defense.
You gotta be one of the few people left then, because what I'm hearing from like other founders is like, it's hard being just like a non-AI company.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. I'll give you my perspective, which is I remember in 2019 and 2020, Victor, when what you talked about a lot was synthetic media. Mm-hmm. That idea, it's just like, I couldn't really figure it out. And what's hilarious is now that's just like generative AI, generative content, generative images, mm-hmm. videos. So it's kind of a little bit scary of how prescient you were in seeing that future and maybe calling it a different name, but now having the whole society coalesce around that.
Dude, it's so funny. Like, I remember we had this meeting late at night and we're kind of like, what should we name this space? Like, how should we refer to this stuff, right? And actually, we started off calling it generative AI because GANs was the generative adversarial networks, which was the first technology that proved really useful for generating images and videos. And also like the V1 of Synthesia was built on GANs. And so the generative part of that like, kind of made sense. But they were like, ah, it's too geeky. Like, no one's going to like generative AI. Let's go with synthetic media. And I remember we spoke to a few other companies who were doing kind of similar things. And we all decided that synthetic media was going to be the word. And then like 4 years later, we were all just like, oh, all the SEO juice we lost out on by calling it synthetic media. It's like really dumb.
That's so funny. For those listening that don't know, because obviously we know, what does Synthesia do?
So Synthesia is an AI video communications platform. And ultimately what we do is we help our customers communicate better by using video that's generated with AI. So in the world we live in today, right, most people prefer to watch and listen to their content. They don't want to read that much anymore. We still consume a lot of text, especially when we're at work, but most people remember very little of what they read. And we offer a platform where our customers can go in and they can essentially transform their documents or PowerPoints, that's what we're mostly seeing today, into video content. So let's say you have a global sales team and you want to make sure your sales team is kept up to date on what's happening with the product, what's happening in the competitive landscape, all the things that's important for our sales team to know and understand. You can send out emails, you can make Notion pages, you can do all these things and people do that, but nobody remembers anything of what they read. And we essentially help them by turning that into video. So the platform is a SaaS platform. You go in, start at $30 a month, goes all the way up to the enterprise, which is very focused. And you select one of these AI avatars, which is essentially kind of a human, looks like a human. It could be yourself, could be one of our stock avatars. And you type out the script, works in 140 different languages. And we have a whole kind of, you can think of it almost like a Canva PowerPoint style editor that sits around it. So you can make a video with a screen recording or an avatar talking or text on the screen or whatever.
It's so cool. Is it weird? For a while, we were the only game in town and for years. And now, going back to our earlier point, synthetic media turned into generative AI. That's like become cool. Josh, many of your peers have invested in ankle biter companies, all of those companies are now building the benchmarks and frameworks for us versus Synthesia, which has got to be like a very, like, how weird is that feeling now being the kind of gorilla in the room that like everyone is doing feature parody stuff with, and there's people that are now as well funded. It's got to be an odd feeling considering the journey to this point.
I think for many years, it was kind of our little secret that this was a real market with real use cases. I think a lot of people looked at it from the outside and kind of dismissed it. And the reason people dismissed it was because a lot of those people were maybe like VCs or executives in big companies who would never be the actual audience for who our customers were creating video for. I'd be like, oh, this video is not as good as what I see on YouTube and Netflix. But what we had discovered behind the scenes was that the way people use this technology is not to compare it with a real video. A real video will still is better. But the alternative is text, right? So if you're like a frontline worker in a fast food restaurant, do you want to watch an AI video or do you want to read 15 pages of Word documents, right? I think that was kind of a secret. Now it's much less a secret. Now it's a real market that's emerging. For many years, like, we have a lot of companies who like literally just verbatim copy everything we did. the text on our website, the pages on our website, the functionalities in the product. And it's a weird feeling because you all of a sudden you feel like you're kind of like the big company, right? Like you're the one that everyone is like coming at. And I think that's true. But I think it's also interesting because what you get is you get so many more iterations from other companies to figure out where is the most valuable use case with this technology, right? Like for many years, we were the only ones who was like really pushing to figure out what's the landscape like? What are people going to use AI video for? What are they not going to use it for? And so to that extent, I think it's actually quite energizing and interesting because it's just still so early. We always say it's early. We also said it was early 2 years ago, but it is still really, really early. If you look at how mature these technologies are versus what they're going to be by the end of the year, maybe next year, there's so much more to come. And I actually welcome more iterations with customers, even if it's not ourselves, right? Because what we all want to do is want to build technology that helps people do something better.
Yeah. I think that's well said. Do you get pissed off, Josh? Like, okay, not pissed off, but are you like, hey, come on, like now that it's cool, everyone's piling in. And then how does that feeling of like, okay, we've been doing this for a few years and Victor, Steph and the team are like trying to figure out basically how to hit escape velocity from here, away from the competition. How do you generally think about that from your shoes?
I have a twin brother, for those who don't know in the audience, and I naturally grew up just insanely competitive. Like it's just like always been a part of me. So yes, like do I have my competitive juices starting to flow? Like very much so after finding out about this. Having said that, I think that now that we have competition, it almost has made us perform a little bit better, actually, I would say across the board. Like it almost keeps you on your toes and makes sure that you are really cutting your teeth and moving as fast as humanly possible. So I actually think it's been a good thing for us as a company and you as a leader, I'd say, and seeing you the last, you know, couple quarters.
Why?
Because I think you have walls to bounce off, right? Like I think when you're the only game in town and we've been killing it, right? Like it's been absolutely insane. It is still an absolutely insane growth journey. But when there's less walls to bounce off of, there's less signal that you see, as I said before, right? Like there's less iterations with other people. You learn less to some extent, right? And I think what it also does is it forces you to just focus even more and even better. Because you have to take a position, right? And for us, for example, like we're very centered on the enterprise. There are other companies out there that are more focused on kind of like the lower end of the market. It's interesting to see how the lower end of the market probably has like different use case than the enterprise. Underlying technologies are the same. The expression of the product that people will need are different. And I think that's really, really healthy, right? So yeah, I think it's fun. Like I'm also a very, very competitive person. If it's just easy and you're just free floating on top of it, it's like, that's not so exciting, right?
Yeah. Do you think in some ways just that competition sharpens your edges? Whereas before you're like, all right, I'm just trying to figure out what works. The last thing you're thinking about, for example, is like, how do I up-level my executive team right now? Or how do I redefine my messaging to a specific set of customers? Whereas now it's like, oh, I need to be on every one of these details and we need to raise the bar across the organization because it's not just us.
For sure. And I think what happens often in markets that are kind of new like ours, right, is that people set out to build fairly like general purpose platform because it's very exciting that you can like serve everyone and anyone at the same time. But then as competition enters in, right, you have to take a position. You have to figure out what are the customers that you deeply care about actually really want? How is that different from other customers? And I think it's just not just now space, but in a lot of other spaces, when you kind of look back at history, right? That is always what happens. There's someone who cracks like some new market. I think the expression of the kind of avatar product, we were probably the ones who like, we definitely pioneered that. But now there's 10 different ways you can build an avatar company. The question is like, which is the biggest market? What's the most interesting product to build for whoever the founders and the team is? And I think that's what gets put much more in perspective when you start to get more competition, right?
Yeah, I think that's well said.
Especially for creative tools, it's a sort of an interesting product because creative tools are per definition very open-ended. You look at like, what's the use case for PowerPoint, for example? That's actually kind of hard to like nail down exactly what the use case of PowerPoint. There's a million different use cases of PowerPoint. What's the use case of Canva, right? Well, I mean, you can definitely list up a bunch of different things, but creative products are much, much more open-ended. And that's fantastic because it means the TAM is like absolutely gigantic. But it also means that you have to make more kind of hard choices versus if you're building like a very vertical application for one specific use case, one specific customer, then your roadmap to some extent, I think, is kind of more clear, right? And I think that's really interesting. Like that's why I love building what is ultimately is a creative tool, right?
Josh, when you see across the board, there's, except for maybe 2021 to 2022, there's one, maybe two winners in a given category. It's very rare that a category has space for five companies. we tricked ourselves into thinking maybe the note-taking category was one of them. It probably won't be, you know, like that'll probably all get rolled up. Does the sense of urgency to now go and hit that escape velocity come from this place where it is relatively winner take all in basically every one of these categories, whether that's vertical software, whether that's the creative tool sets? I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that resonates a lot. I think what people tend not to realize is, at least the going assumption in the last decade, was that most of the disproportionate market share goes to the number one company in consumer markets. That's also true actually in enterprise. And I don't think people really take that into consideration. And some of my favorite companies are those that actually create new categories. But definitionally, it's really hard to create a category. But the minute it's there and it's properly created and you have all the awareness around it, then it's go time. Then you have to go as fast as humanly possible to capture as much share. So you become the de facto brand, because that has such compounding power for many, many, many years. And really the way to do that is just to raise the bar of operational excellence across the board. And that means a lot of different things depending on the different company. But really it's about getting out there and showing kind of what you're capable of and why your product is special.
On the creating the category piece, I think that probably from our perspective, that's when we'd like to invest, is when that category has been created. The challenge, I would imagine, for the entrepreneur is that getting to the point of a flicker of category creation is not a very fun process, to put it lightly. And I think you probably had one of the least fun processes of finding product market fit that I've ever heard of. When you started, this was 2017, how did the idea of the company come about?
It was definitely like a long journey. I don't know if it's the hardest ever, but it was definitely long, right? We founded the company in 2017, and I've said this a few times before, but I think we essentially kind of did what you're supposed to not do, is that we fell in love with the technology more than we fell in love with like a specific problem that we wanted to solve, right? There was a problem, but what got us very excited and led us to start the company was the first sort of research paper really showing that neural networks, there's a glimpse of them being able to actually generate video frames that looks and feels highly realistic. That's the research paper called Face to Face, which my co-founder Matthias Niesner did back in 2016. And kind of when I saw that, I just had that glimpse of like, this is going to change everything we know about media production. It's very, very, very early. At that point, was definitely not in a state where it could do anything that's actually useful to anyone. But I felt like it was so interesting, right? And of course, there was a problem. The problem is like, people want to make more videos, but video is like really difficult to make. But it wasn't like, oh, people in the enterprise really deeply care about making customer support videos in like 120 different languages, and they want like a full end-to-end platform to do that. So we set out with a very, very kind of open, naive mind of thinking about this as like a sequencing exercise. We knew that at one point, this technology is going to be powerful enough that you can create a Hollywood film on a laptop, right? That's not the market we're going for, but if you anchor like the power of the technology to that, that's definitely going to happen. And from where we are today, probably maybe even in less than 5 years. The question is like, how do you then sequence a company to get there? Because obviously trying to build that back in 2017 would have totally failed. So we tried to find the right product, which we felt like we could reasonably build for the $1 million that we raised, which is not a lot in kind of deep tech terms. And we felt like someone would buy it. What that ended up being was this idea of AI video dubbing, which interestingly enough now has actually made a comeback. But basically, give me a video in whatever language and I'll translate it by changing the voice, of course, but also changing all the facial expressions and like lip sync it to the new language. And we went out to market with this. This was like a super manual product, right? It was like 3 PhDs had to spend like 2 weeks on creating like a 40-second clip. So we naturally went to big video production agencies. We even tried like Hollywood studios and so on and so forth. Basically people who were already making lots of video, and we were like, we have a tool that'll make your video creation better. And it was not a total disaster. Like I think we did something like 600, 700 million, maybe even dollars in revenue in like 18 months after we built the product. But it's very, very service driven. It's like you have to look exactly in the camera at all times. Very, very constrained, right? Now that technology works very well as like a general purpose thing. You've probably all seen examples of this recently. You just like drop the video and it comes out in different language because the technology has advanced. But basically for us back then, we figured out that these people liked the product, but it was a vitamin at best, right? Their house is not on fire. These guys are already making really awesome video content all the time. And we can help them make it slightly better, but we're not at all in control of the process, because like the AI video dubbing is like the last pass you do after you had convinced David Beckham to do an ad with you. You've done all the creative work. You got it signed off. That whole part of the process, I have no say in at that point, right? I'm like 27 years old and run like a 9-person company. We could come in at the end of that and we could help them make it a little bit better, but it wasn't a painkiller. It was a vitamin, right? And we were not in control of the go-to-market motion. But what we did learn in those years was, because we just spoke to so many people, we spoke to like thousands of people among me and Steph, my co-founder, what we learned was that there are billions of people in the world who are desperate to make video content, who are not making video content today, because they don't know how to operate a camera. They can't get the budget internally to go through the video production team to help them make that video. And they just have no idea where to start. And for these people, when you talk to them, their house is on fire. Like they really, really want to make video content. And so from talking to them and building a few kind of basic demos of what became the avatar technology, what we learned was that for these people, if we can give them a solution that's 1,000 times more affordable and 1,000 times easier to use than a camera, they're okay with the quality being slightly less than what you get out of a camera. That took us towards the direction of the product that we have today. And I think it's actually, to some extent, a fairly classical story of like new technologies, right? There's a new technology that comes up and people immediately go to like, oh, the people who are already doing something related to this technology would probably love to do it or to use this technology. But the real big market is actually democratizing, right? It's like enabling a bunch of people who couldn't make videos before, didn't really maybe care that much about video. Enabling them to make video is the really powerful thing. And so it very simply, once we launched the product, it just took off like crazy. I think we had that feeling of like, wow, this is like really what product market fit probably feels like. We're just getting so many people in, want to use the product. They want to pay us money. They want to sign up for like an enterprise contract. And there was like the spark of that product market fit, which we then of course took and kind of molded over time.
Are there historical comps of other category creation companies that went to the existing obvious areas to augment their sets of services, like in your case, going to producers? I don't know, I'm just trying to think, like, is that like PCs going to schools? What are the comps?
I have a bad analogy, but it's effectively like the first few years of the mobile era when everyone was trying to retrofit a desktop UX into this like mobile device, and it was janky and it was ugly and no one really understood what like mobile native means. And then all of a sudden people were like, wow, there's just like this GPS system and accelerometer and all these really cool things we can do. And then comes out Uber and Instacart and a bunch of other really cool apps. That's probably the analogy I'd have.
Yeah, but I'll say things like cameras and phone, for example, right? I like the idea of like cheap cameras. A lot of people thought that when we get cameras on our phones, we're all going to be taking photos like photographers, and like the kind of medium of professional photography would be translated into the mobile era, right? But what happens is when you give this to a bunch of people who have no idea what to do with photos, all of a sudden they take a lot of photos and it's kind of like the format sort of evolves with totally. That into something very different. And now we're in an era, interestingly, right, where all kind of user-generated content on purpose wants to not look polished, right?
Yeah, it's like shitty selfies from teenagers.
Exactly. The first iteration of Instagram was very much built on, we help you make your photos look professional. They gave you these filters, which was the one hack, I think, that unlocked it, because all of a sudden people felt like they're actually like a great photographer because a filter makes everything look great. And then we had this era of like people trying to emulate professional photography. And then it sort of evolved into where we are today with TikTok, which is like big brands almost like doing videos of like someone sitting in their car, just like talking to their phone because it feels like more authentic and real, right? We always see like when technologies get democratized in this sense, then people invent new media formats and they often do things that would be very hard to predict before the moment that it happened, right? I'm pretty sure if you ask McKinsey consultants 5 years before Instagram came out, what people would do if they could take great photos, they would not have come up with the world of social media that we see today.
Do you have a vision for what the next era looks like here in this space? And you might be wrong, by the way. Like we could look back in 2-3 years and say that that was the wrong vision. That's the fun and scary part of continuing to be the category creator. But yeah, where do you see this going?
This space is like, sure, there's a category today of like avatar companies, but I really think there's still a lot of things that's up in there. Like AI video, is that a category? I think what Runway ML is trying to do, as we're trying to do, is do very, very different things. Like I think Runway is trying to help people with no budget become Hollywood directors and make really awesome films. Our vision is actually more anchored in something like PowerPoint 2.0. We want to enable visual storytelling for everyone, and we want to do that by transforming more of your existing content, as in like PowerPoints, text documents, turning that into video, which I think is distinctively different from like a Runway or Sora or whatever, right? If you think of any kind of consumer, let's take a young person just to flesh it out even more, right? When they're not at work, how much content do they consume that is text? Let's leave out text messages here. most people consume almost entirely like podcasts and videos, including myself. When I want to learn something, I will usually like kick it off with a YouTube video. I'll listen to a podcast maybe. I'll go on TikTok. And I maybe buy the book on Amazon as like the fifth step if I'm really, really interested in a topic. But in my private life, I mostly consume video and audio by now. I read very little, even though I actually love reading. For most people, that's true. But then when they go to work, it's the opposite. They read a lot of documents. They send a lot of emails. It's very, very text-driven today. And we want to bring that experience of being able to consume every piece of content in video and audio that you do in your private life, because that's actually what you prefer. That's what you do when no one is looking. We want to bring that to the enterprise. And so that's the kind of direction that we're moving towards. We think that, well, science shows that video is much more engaging, has much higher information retention, and that's a win-win, both for the person consuming it and for the company who ultimately wants the employees to be the most well-informed that they can. So that's the direction we're moving in. Now, to get there, there's a bunch of things that needs to be solved. One of them is the overall, just the general quality and fidelity of the avatars and devices. We've seen the space, everything in AI, of course, is moving incredibly fast right now. I think this is going to be the year of speech and video becoming really, really good. Last year was the year of text with LLMs obviously becoming very, very powerful. Avatar technology in general is still a little bit behind text and maybe even also speech, where we've seen speech that are now like more or less indistinguishable from humans. We have that technology as well. Just about when this podcast is being released, we're releasing our expressive avatars, which is the first avatar technology where the avatar somewhat understands what it's saying. So you put in some text, right? And if you put in something that's happy, you put in something that's sad or excited or disappointed, then the avatar will actually understand it. The voice inflection will match that. The body language, the expressions in the face, they know it. They're kind of acting it out. They're performing it like a human would do. Whereas a lot of the avatar technology today is like quite stiff and a bit monotone. That's going to be a big shift. From just road testing this with our clients for the last couple of months, that really unlocks a bunch of new use cases where a lot of the use cases up until now has been sort of internal facing. This is going to be the unlock, I think, for much more external facing use cases.
Because the internal use case today is kind of a stone-faced avatar going through what was a very boring, I don't know, HR document and making that much more interesting just by having video as a different modality, but probably not good for sending out customer emails about a product announcement that shows excitement in the avatar's face.
Yeah, exactly. I think of this as like, if you use voice as another, as an example of this, right? Which of course is a big part of what we're developing as well. Then before we used very large models to build these voices, which is essentially what's happened with us, 11 Labs, amazing company doing voice as well. Probably a lot of people will have heard of them. Essentially, the trick there is you train it on like huge amounts of data and these systems learn to sound much more natural. The era before that in text-to-speech was like your Siri or Alexa type of voice. Now, that's like already a pretty big market, but it's very utilitarian by nature. If you're like getting directions when you're in your car, it's fine that it's like a Siri Alexa type of voice, which sounds a bit clunky and a bit robotic, right? But you wouldn't sit down and listen to your Alexa read out an entire audiobook over 2 hours because the voice is not good enough for that, right? So it's good for these like utilitarian purposes, but it's not good enough to be entertainment by themselves. I think that's what we're going to see with avatar technology this year, is that today there is like the host and they're utilitarian, like they can tell you something. Usually there'll be some like visual backdrop to it that they're kind of going through explaining. But the avatar in itself is not interesting enough that you would come home after a long day at work and watch a 15-minute avatar video. It's not there yet, right? But that's going to come this year. They're going to become good enough that I think people will actually like watching them just for the sake of whatever that they're saying. And that's going to be pretty big. And I think another way of thinking of this is like it's going to break through the uncanny valley, like voice has already done it. That's going to be really, really impactful.
And can you explain for those that don't know what the uncanny valley is?
So the uncanny valley is a concept that comes mostly from film. And it's essentially when we as humans see like depictions of digital humans, essentially. It's kind of like a spectrum. If you see something that's like very cartoony and which is very obviously like not a real video, we kind of like that because it's more like fun. It's interesting. It's like a Pixar film or something like that. And then as we go further up the scale of like realism, we can go quite far up in like computer games, whatever. We kind of like to see that. But right before it gets to actually break through the uncanny valley, as in like you cannot tell that this is a computer generated person that you're looking at in a film, for example, right before that, we really don't like it. That's the uncanny valley. It's like when it's almost there. It's like 5%
of being real enough.
We can tell something's off. Then we prefer that it's more kind of lo-fi because then it just becomes like fun and interesting. But if it's really trying to pretend, but you can tell it's not there, there's something in us that just goes like, ick, I don't like this. And So the uncanny valley is when you break through that, right? And you actually can create content which you cannot tell is synthetic. I think we're very close. I think with the technology we're coming out with now, we'll almost be there. And by the end of the year, we'll definitely be there. And that's going to be very, very impactful. And I think the TAM is going to like 100x, 1000x once that happens.
Hearing you talk about the way that you learn and consume different mediums, I'm the same way. That's why I started a podcast here, because I just think that's going to be the future of how people consume information. It reminds me of our partner Ilya led the Series A of Loom, which got bought by Atlassian for just shy of $1 billion. And if you ask the Atlassian CEO, why did he do this? What he says is that his nieces and nephews, they're like 14, 15 years old, all communicate exclusively through photo and video. That's it. It's all like Snapchat and Instagram. That's it. They don't even really text anymore. And to see where they are, they don't even ask each other. They just go and find my friends. Or there's now like new apps that are just like geolocating people. And he was like, look, in 5 years, not even, she's going to be in the workforce. And all of her friends are going to be in the workforce. And that's going to be the expectation that they have on how they want to communicate just with their colleagues, let alone with external parties and customers and that kind of thing. It reminds me of this.
It's going to be table stakes in not very many years. Today, it's like, oh, wow, that's nice. I get to watch a video at work, or someone took time out of their day to make a great video for the Salesforce, explain like a new product feature, right? That feels nice when you're at work today, because it's like, oh, wow, that's interesting. That's great. And you remember more of it. But in not very long, it's going to be table stakes. I just don't think you're going to have people reading 25-page manuals for how to sell a product, how to do something. People want it to be audio and video driven. And I think also increasingly, which is going to be very much powered by LLMs, which I think that's a force multiplier on everything that we do and all these kind of AI content modalities. They'll want it increasingly personalized.
Yeah.
So for example, if you're a salesperson, what if like before you jump on a call with someone, instead of having like an entry in Salesforce with some Zoom info data and like what the company is, what they do, things you need to know before you jump on that call, what if you had like a 4-minute video of an avatar, like super high quality, that just goes through who you're about to talk to, what do they care about, what's some of the recent news about the company, here's a graph showing how much revenue they're doing in 5 minutes. That's unthinkable to do today because it'd be way too much work for someone to actually record that, but that would be super powerful. And you do get this to some extent sometimes in the real world, right? A salesperson might talk to an SDR, let's talk to that person before and give you some additional context on it. That's going to be where this stuff really excels, right? It's going to be when these new media formats really begin to utilize the fact that everything here is generated by code, which means infinite amount of possibilities. You're not tied to something that's hard-baked off a camera. Right now, we're just still very early. Right now, we are essentially a better way of making MP4 files because we've taken the camera out of the equation. You can do it from behind your desk. But the true power of this is going to be once it develops into a new type of file format where the video, the audio we consume is going to be generated just for you on demand. And that seemed very hard 5 years ago. Now, I think we have the intelligence layer. Like LLMs are obviously very, very powerful. And with the video and audio tools being developed now, you'll be able to translate that kind of whatever the LLM reasons into a really nice visual that goes with it as well.
This is a weird analogy, but isn't it kind of like a multimodal Grammarly? Like when I write emails and stuff in Grammarly, which just checks my work, it then sends me an email summary at the end of every week. And it shows me what my tone was across all of these different emails. And so the technology is just now getting to the point where it can recognize without me telling it what my different tonalities are in a sets of emails. And I'm like, oh, I was in a bad mood last week, you know, or I was in a great mood, whatever it was. But now you're basically taking that text, being able to synthesize it in the same way, and then layering on video on top of that with all of the technology behind that, and then giving that kind of power to the hands of enterprises, right?
Up until now, text has more or less been like the only truly scalable way we have of like storing communication or, you know, knowledge. If you think of like all the world's information today, probably 99.9% of it is stored as text somewhere. Because if you had to make a podcast about every single piece of information, well, like you would just never do that, right? So today it's like only the most important knowledge probably that's like available in audio and video format. And in the grand scheme of things, a lot of things in the enterprise is maybe like not the most valuable content that you have. And so it will never become audio video. And what's going to happen now is that as we move into a world in which it'll be as easy to create video or audio content as it is to type something out, it's going to be very, very transformational in terms of how we communicate. There's even, there's like a thesis called the Gutenberg parenthesis, which the idea here is essentially that when we look back in like thousands of years of like the history of how we've communicated, text is going to having end up being just a parenthesis in the middle. And the reason for that is if you think of text as a way of communicating, it's very, very low dimensional, right? Like when you text someone versus when you speak to someone in real life, you communicate so much more in real life or in a video because you have your body language, you have your tone of voice, like all these things, that which is why we prefer to communicate in real life. But because we're stuck with text today as the only scalable way of communicating at scale, right? That's kind of like what we're using. But at some point, and that may be after our lifetime, someone will invent a method, or maybe it will be actually be in our lifetime, right? It'll be like VR, AR thing, whatever, where you can consume all information as if someone was talking to you or having a conversation with someone, either a real person or an AI. And once we get to that point, what's the point of text anymore? We've always been on this trajectory towards communicating in ways that feels more like what we do in real life. The reason we like to look at pictures is because it reminds us more of what we do in real life, right? The reason that we like video calls is because it reminds us more of how we consume information in real life. And VR is, of course, like the AR is maybe the frontier of that today. And I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, because I think for most people, it is true. It's maybe not in every single case you would always want to have a conversation or have talk to someone who's like you would in real life. But I think a lot of cases you would, right? And so it's interesting to see, if is text going to be around in like 1,000, 2,000 years? I think for most people, if they had a choice, they would probably prefer to watch video and listen to audio.
And Josh, assuming that the underlying primitive that is accelerating all of these trends is the AI stuff that we're talking about, do you think we're overhyped? Do you think when you listen to Victor, are you like, every company is going to transform? We live in this bubble now where it's basically the only thing that possibly could be talked about. Knowing that, are you like, okay, yeah, we're in a moment of time and there's no way it could get more hypey than this? Or listening to folks that are pulling the future forward like Victor, are you like, no, like we're not even close to there yet?
I think there are tectonic plates moving that are going to change a lot of how we think about technology and building software and really just living our lives, both inside and outside the office. I think we do have a tendency as humans to overestimate the rate of that change, though. So while I think the logical conclusion is everything will be personalized at scale and across every information modality, I think it's also really, really important to take a step back and be able to systematically decompose the steps that we can get there and be very cautious and first principled with every step we go, which to Victor's credit is probably one of his superpowers. And as you didn't talk about it much, but like I think led you through this few years of despair trying to raise money from many, many investors and not really getting there, but still having that confidence in that long-term vision and the path to systematically kind of approach that end state.
Yeah. Can you talk about raising, like you mentioned that you and Steph were running around with your first $1 million trying to figure out the early use cases. To Josh's point, can you talk about the journey of actually just getting to that first $1 million? Because the part of the wilderness that we explored was just from that point on, there's still a whole nother segment to the story that predates that.
It was really hard because we were just very early, right? As I said earlier, right, it all kind of started with this research paper that I saw and felt like I saw magic for the first time. And I just got so like obsessed with the idea of how powerful this technology was going to be. And so we kind of assembled a team and we built a thesis. To Josh's point, right, I think sequencing is incredibly important when you're working with like such a big vision. You can't go straight to the end goal, right? Like that will always fail, I think. And so when we went out to try and raise the first round, the premise was basically like, look, this technology is really, really powerful. We have a bunch of ideas about how we can get to an actual product. But if you invest in us, right, it's going to be a journey of finding that. I can't with hand on heart say that I know exactly how this is going to pan out in the next 2 or 3 years. And at that time, I was like 25 or 26 years old. I didn't really have any merits for starting this company. I'm not an AI researcher. I'm not even a software developer. I had a bunch of stuff before this, working like early stage startups. By that time, I think everybody wanted me to be the PhD, right? I think if I'd been a PhD on AI research, they'd been much more inclined to say, okay, this guy is like super smart. We'll give him some money and see what he comes up with. Worst case, it's a $30 million acquihire to Facebook and we get some more Facebook shares. But I don't think that's how people like looked at me, and rightly so, right? I think that was definitely wasn't my profile. And so we got turned down by, I think, like 100 investors, something like that. And
actually 100? Like actually that many people?
Yeah.
Like that's not the reconstructed narrative of how hard
it was. We actually found the list of people we talked to in those early days. And I think it's like roughly around 100 in Europe and the US. And also we were in Europe, right? We're in London. And as much as I love Europe, like the general appetite for risk and like crazy ideas is way, way, way lower than it is on the West Coast. But after like being turned down by a lot of people, we had like one of the names on our list we wanted to get in touch with is Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban built Broadcast.com, right? Which there's actually a lot of analogies to what we're trying to do here. There's like the first internet radio technology where people are like, why would anyone want radio on the internet? That's like the stupidest idea ever, right? But they kind of pushed through. They obviously did really well. They sold the company for like billions of dollars. And he also had this, so he had this kind of media and technology, pretty good in that Venn diagram. Stefan found his email in a kind of leaked hack somewhere on the internet, pretty interesting, his Gmail. We sent him an email, just like a very short email saying, hey, we're working on this, here's a video of the tech kind of in action. He responded back within 5 minutes, and he was just like, I love it, send us some more questions. And we emailed back and forth with him for like 10 hours or something, until 3:30 a.m. in the morning, London time, where he was basically like, I'll do the round, assuming all diligence goes through. It's like $1 million. And I think the learning there was that when we then met him after he had kind of invested, he was like, I actually built a prototype of this tech myself with a lecturer. So he knew everything about the technology. He had exactly the same vision as we had. And so he was evaluating us and the way we were thinking about the business, right? And that was very distinctively different from every other person that we spoke to who had never heard about this technology before, had a very hard time extrapolating where this could go and how important it would be for the media landscape. It's one of the things like finding someone who shares the vision and is evaluating the team is a hell of a lot easier to close around with than someone where you have to like first take them through, this is the technology, this is the vision where we think it's going to go, and this is how we think we're going to get there.
And are you guys like huddled up over the computer, just like figuring out how to draft freaking email responses and then being like, are you kidding me? You already responded. And then you got to go back and do it again.
We actually tracked this at one point. We had a spreadsheet where when we would ping Mark with like anything, how quickly he responds. And I think the average was 4.5 minutes. Mark is like amazing. He's so quick to respond. He's a very, very, very smart guy. And so it's been really great working with him. And we'll very be grateful for him taking a bet when no one else that took.
Well, it's interesting because if you ask, like we had Joe Lacob on stage at the CEO summit that we were just doing, and he said the number one thing that he prides himself on and that he coaches the organization on is responsiveness. There was a litany of things that I thought he was going to say. I did not think he'd choose responsiveness, but I completely get it. This idea of someone, what an interesting way to show that you care by just being quick to respond. I don't know, I think there's something to it.
And also like to take it all back to all the video talk, right? Think about how much longer you take to phrase important emails as opposed to if you're in the same room with the person. There's so much less information in an email. So you really think about what's my tone of voice? How long should this be? Like all these kind of things that go through your head when you're like responding to important emails. But probably if you're in the room with the person, it'd just be easier, right?
Yeah. Josh, to Victor's point, like not a PhD AI person, European company. There's like very little precedent for any big companies being built in Europe. Starting with the technology and then working backwards towards a, these are like all of the cardinal sins of venture capital.
I would have passed myself.
Yeah, these are like were you not asking yourself these questions of like, all right, none of this fits any pattern that is supposed to build a big company?
Yeah, absolutely. It's why we passed foolishly on the seed and the Series A. So we made a big mistake. And what we saw it initially, I think when Victor came in, we thought he was exceptional as a founder for a lot of different reasons, but we felt like it was almost a toy. We just didn't really, we couldn't extrapolate how this could find its way into as an enterprise software product. He really proved us wrong. And what was also remarkable is everything he told me he would do at the seed round and at the Series A round, he actually did and more. And that's just really rarefied air in startup world. So yeah, sometimes some of the best companies are the ones that don't meet the criteria people look for.
And I think it's like, looking back now, it's easy to say, but I think it actually ended up being our biggest strength that I'm not like a researcher, essentially. Because me and Stefan, my other co-founder, who's also non-technical in that sense, we just ran around for 3 years just speaking to like thousands of people to really try and build a first principle understanding of what is video, why do people care about video, how do people want to make video, and always with the goal in mind of building a business, right? And I think part of that was also because we felt like this is an era where every professor at a great university was like starting a company, hiring 3 or 4 or 5 PhDs, raising some money for some VCs, building something interesting, and getting bought by a big fan company for like $30, $40, $50 million in an acqui-hire. And that was kind of a path that people were like sort of planning for. And I think a lot of VCs was like, that's kind of a pretty good insurance strategy. If that happens and we invested at like 20 million and they get bought for 40, it's like, whatever, right? That's worth the kind of the bet. But we always felt like we don't have that option. No one's going to come and buy us for $50 million because I'm not the guy that Meta wants, right? They want the guy who's like insanely good at the research and everyone will be like wanting to work with. So we always felt like we have to build a business. There's no other path for us to do like a quick acqui-hire to one of the big fan companies. And most of the companies got funded this era. Exactly that happened. There's lots of, I don't know if they were great companies or like at least like very interesting research companies that got bought at the time. But because we're kind of forced to build a business, we're also forced to build a product and forced to find customers, which is a luxury I think a lot of AI companies that era didn't necessarily have to do because it was such a hunt for talent.
Yeah. It's insane. I mean, it's like absolutely insane. How instructive do you think those battle scars are to the culture of the company today? Meaning, I'm just thinking about this now, but it's an interesting tension of scarcity throughout the entire origin of the company for 3+ years, right? Just like never having enough. And now you're kind of in an era of abundance. You just raised that over $1 billion. You raised another 100 million or so from Excel. You're the cool, sexy kid on the block now. You're one of like 7 European unicorns. And there's plenty of AI technology to go around. There's now all of a sudden people that can actually purpose-built focus on moving the platform and the technology forward. There's a name for all these things. How do you live between those two worlds of like, all right, now you're getting pushed and you're in the spotlight, but your whole origin story is one of scarcity, like I said.
I think it has shaped a lot of the culture. We talked about the first funding round now, right? But the second one was almost even more catastrophic because the first funding round was like, either we get some money and we try and do this.
The Cuban round, right?
Yeah. Like that's either we get some money and we try this out or we don't get some money. We've wasted like, I don't know, 6-7 months. The second seed round took me like 9 months to raise. It was like an absolute desert walk. And we were very close to going bankrupt at the time. And I think that definitely shapes the company, right? Because we spent years like really truly in the grind where there was like no one handing out checks for us and saying, ah, just do some cool research and like we'll figure out the business model down the line, right? This was like, well, you have no business models. We're not going to invest and you're not an AI researcher. So, you know, you're not going to get bought by Facebook. Better figure it out if you want to raise some money. And I think we've definitely brought that with us today. One of the mantras we have internally in Synthesia is what we call utility over novelty, which is essentially being obsessed not about the technology in itself, but driving value for our customers, right? It's one of those things that kind of sound dumb if you speak to someone who doesn't work in tech, because like, obviously if you run a business, you would want to like make a product that people want to buy. But when you work with these like exciting technologies, right? It can be easy to get lost in driving attention and interest and wow moments or PR moments that's exciting or gets people riled up and gets them going. Because they don't always correlate with building a great product that people want to use over the long term, not because it's interesting and sexy, but because it actually solves a problem for them. And I think we've always defaulted back to like, of course you want to utilize the fact that it's a jaw-dropping technology, it has this like magic thing to it that's very good for like a go-to-market perspective and driving interest, but it's very important we convert that interest and awareness into actual business use cases, right? So, you know, what I get the most excited about is talking to a customer who's like an Italian cement mixing company with like 7,000 employees. You've never heard of them before. And the person I'm talking to could not give less of a F about AI or LLMs or GPT style technologies, right? They're trying to do their job better. And we're providing a solution for them to do it. They don't use it because it's AI or because it's cool or interesting. They're just like, I need to get this job done and this tool helps me do it better. And obsessing about those types of customers and those types of users is very important for us. And that's important because they're ultimately the ones who will help us succeed, right? Doing big, flashy PR campaigns and moments is great in many ways, but I think it can be very easy to get lured in by that. And I think that can be like pretty fatal potholes if you're not obsessed over like actually driving utility, not just doing things for the sake of being kind of novel. So I think that that's a very important part of the Synthesia DNA.
Yeah, Josh, isn't that like an interesting thing that we see all the time here now, especially exacerbated in this AI world where you have one group of founders that come in that are all technology based. They're building foundational models. They're raising $100 million from NVIDIA. They're constantly focused on the research and the PhD level science of pushing these models to their boundaries. They have no commercial orientation at all. It's just not in their DNA. Whereas on the flip side, you might have someone like you, which was the knock of you, which there's very few of you actually in this world, which would be like, oh, you're not technical. in air quotes. However, I guess the feature, not bug, in this case about your background is that you're figuring out customer problems and then working backwards to figure out how to retrofit that technology into it.
I think there's something very powerful about deep tech combined with customer obsession. And I often find that in like founding teams of companies, it's rare to find that combination of the two things. I think to some extent, I'd argue that a lot of the autonomous driving stuff we've seen in the last 5-10 years have a bit of the same flavor of that problem, which is like you raise a lot of money, you get very obsessed about technology, but it's not always driven by like solving customer problems or customer obsession. I think there's also, of course, many stories of the opposite being true, right? You could argue to some extent that OpenAI, which of course is like the fantastical success of the last, well, I think they started 7 or 8 years ago as well. And they very much started from like a pure research-driven thing, but they were very good at then figuring out, okay, now we've built something that's interesting and valuable. Let's figure out how people can use it. So it's of course, every rule has exceptions. But even when I do angel investing myself today, I generally prefer investing in more kind of deep tech companies. Putting that like customer obsession and helping with that is something I love to do with founders, especially those who are technical, that can very easily get caught up in the excitement about building the technology, right? Or the vanity metrics around doing something that lots of people find very interesting and very cool. And they're very supportive. But when you ask them to actually pay for it, not just once, but like over time and renew their contracts and those sorts of things, maybe less inclined to do so.
Yeah. Our partner Ilya says that the one rule of venture capital is that there's no rules. And I think this is exactly why, because there are so many ways to go carve out this path. The only rule that I have found is people's ability to overcome hardship more effectively than others, hence the name of this show. And I think you're kind of the ultimate embodiment of that. So it's incredible to see. Do you feel pressure now? Do you feel pressure now, Josh? Like, do you guys feel like, oh shit, this is working. This is real. At least before, there was no pressure of expectation. It was the inverse of it, right? Now, if we're investing at the Series B and someone's investing, like, there's multiple expectations. You know, there's now expectations of you to capture this opportunity in front of you. I'd love to hear from both of you. Like, how do you think about that pressure now?
No, of course there's more pressure, right? Like that kind of comes with raising more money, increasing valuation, and a market that's heating up. But ultimately, like sure, there's pressure, and that can be, I think it can be healthy, it can be unhealthy if it's too much pressure, of course. But I think in very practical terms, what it means for me and what I spend a lot of my time thinking about is like, now we actually have a big business, right? A very big, very real business with lots of customers that are happy they're using our product, which is awesome. But now you have to kind of balance that with also being very nimble and quick and doing new things and being fast. When you're pre-product market fit and trying to product market fit, you have nothing to lose, right? You can be very extreme in the way you do things, very extreme in the way you test things, very extreme in the way you build like MVPs and kind of research the market and figure out like where's your space in it. But once you become a real company, right, you actually have something to lose. I can't just steer the ship like 180 degrees the other way and be like, hey guys, you know what? We're just going to do this thing now, right? Uh-huh. I think so. That's one of the things that as you grow up, you have kind of the pressure of actually having something that's working and a real business. That's something I spend a lot of my time thinking about. How do we strike the right balance from an org structure perspective? How do we make sure we set ourselves up in a way where we get the best of both worlds? I think that's a very interesting part of that pressure. So I can see the pressures being ultimately more from customers than from investors. Of course, those two follow each other very closely. If all of our customers, the customer pressure becomes very high because they don't like what we're doing and they start churning, then the investor's not going to be happy. But ultimately, it all comes back to the customer, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Like, yeah, I think that's well. Do you feel pressure?
How do you even not like Victor? I think it's lonely at the top. Like honestly, for CEOs, it's on you, and there's kind of no backstop in some ways. So my job as a VC is really to push when I see potential, and that just keeps going up. So I have to kind of keep the pressure on Victor a little bit to make him perform at his best, and you know, support when we hit the lows, as we inevitably will. But no, it's kind of game on right now.
But you don't like go to sleep at night being like, this has the potential to be a generational N of one company.
Yeah, it's ours to lose.
Yeah, exactly. Like you feel that at night.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You feel that at night. But isn't it even worse when like, at least when Victor feels it, he can like go put his hands on the steering wheel and like actually affect change.
Totally.
Isn't it a different type of feeling when all you can really do is feel the pressure? You can apply a healthy amount of pressure, but ultimately there's no way we're going to be able to put more pressure on him than he and the customers are already putting on himself, you know? So doesn't that kind of make it a more frustrating feeling when you're like, there's only so much?
Yeah, yeah. Especially for me, I just really like being in control. And I think one of the realities of a venture capital is like, that's just not the case. Like you have to lead by influence. And really at any one time, there's probably only one thing that's actually important. Can I make sure that that one thing we make progress on either by our own efforts through our network or resources, or really just through surrounding Victor with the right people and kind of anecdotes?
For sure. For sure. But it's also what makes it fun, right? If it was easy, then I don't think it wouldn't be as interesting.
Definitely not. Well, I appreciate you both doing this. Can I end with, when we were sitting down at dinner talking, we were exploring this idea of like the founder just having a different fundamental set of motivations than basically everybody else in the world. I was talking about this idea about like during COVID, how I sold everything and just traveled out of a suitcase. And I felt so liberated. Like I just felt so free having so little. And you were talking about how you like made a bunch of money in crypto randomly, which I had no idea. Did you know that? I had no idea. And bought the nice watch and all these things. And now you're like the fancy company and all these things. But there's this satisfaction that you were describing to me that you get about getting on a Lyft bike in the morning and just biking to the office and seeing all the like nice cars in London that are driving by. Just kind of knowing that none of those things are tethering you to what you want to go build.
Yeah, I'm a very obsessive person. And I'm especially obsessive about like fringe ideas. And that can be expressed as like weird AI research in 2017 that eventually turned into Synthesia. Or it can be like crate digging techno records from the 80s that like no one has heard before. Like I love this kind of like weird, strange idea. That's always been my motivation for building. But I think of course there's also the element of like, you know, money and success is a part of all of our lives and identities. And I think you just go through this thing where like in my early 20s, like it's definitely like want to make like money, want to be successful and do all these different things, even though you know a lot of people tell you that that's not the end be of all. And I think for me, it was just like, it's just kind of interesting when you then like you attain like at least some level of that, then you have to try it for yourself, right? Like you have to figure out, does it actually make you happy to have a really nice watch? And of course the answer is for a week, maybe it's fun to walk around with your new watch, but then it doesn't really matter. And what matters is doing something you're truly deeply passionate about. And yeah, the example with like driving around the bike is like often when you then get all these things, I think people get very stressed about it. Like you have a really nice car, someone's going to scratch it, you know, it's expensive, you have to pay insurance for it. So I think the best things happened for me the last like 5, 6, 7 years is really being very, very, very focused on what I know I like to do and what interests me, and then just not doing anything else to the extent that it's possible, which is also my weakness, right? And I know exactly what I'm interested in, exactly what I like to do, and know how I want to spend my time. And maybe for some people, that's raising expensive cars. Like, definitely not saying there's anything wrong with that. It's just not the thing that makes me happy.
Yeah. Well, dude, it's amazing to see what you all are doing. And I think I speak for both of us. Like, we can't wait to see what's next. Are you hiring?
Always hiring.
I know you're hiring. What are you hiring for? Everything?
We're hiring more as every team right now.
Where?
New York, London, Europe. West Coast for some roles, go to market. We're growing really, really quickly right now. We want great people who can help us build a generational company, get in front of customers, help us sell it. On the tech side, we're doing a lot of very, very interesting AI research. We've been hard at work for the last 1.5 years, and we're going to drop some really crazy stuff by the end of the year. I think we're at an interesting point in time where like we're big enough to do interesting things because we have the capital, but we're also small enough that anyone who joins the team now can have very true, deep impact on where we go. So anyone who's excited about that mission, just ping me, victor@synthesia.io or LinkedIn, or look at our jobs page and I'll be very happy to speak with you.
When you hear the word grit, what do you think of?
Being relentless, not giving up. And I think more than anything, it's like you have to be an optimist, right? I think me and Steph, my co-founder, and I think Josh knows this from how we run board meetings and everything else, is that we laugh a lot. And actually the worse things are, the more we laugh. We got turned down by like some VC, which we thought was going to go through with like 2 weeks of runway left in the bank or something like that, right? And we just like we get off this call and we just start laughing, both of us. Just like, this is how f***ing absurd is this? We spent 2 years of our life and this shit's going to go into the absolute jitter. That's something that's very important for us. Grit is, I think everyone just finds their own expression of grit. Maybe for some people, it's like running a marathon every weekend to stay focused. For us, it's like laughing a lot, staying optimistic and enjoying the journey. But of course, being relentless while doing so.
It's amazing. Thanks, man. Appreciate it, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jordan.
That's it. Thanks for tuning in. Feel free to come back every Monday morning to listen to a new guest or go back into the archives when we've done more than 100 episodes. This podcast is a Kleiner Perkins production, and the episode was edited by Eric Johnson from Lightning Pod. Thank you all.